Well, you always knew that Peter Major was a world traveler. You didn't know quite how much of a world traveler he was, but in this week's edition of Mining Web Weekly, we're going to find out more about China, where Peter has just returned from to Idaho. He's coming back home to South Africa soon, but we'll talk gold, we'll talk Anglo, we'll talk about South Africa's cadastry catastrophe and lots more. Peter, I know that you flew into Vancouver, and having done that trip a few times when we had a partner in Vancouver some years ago, it's almost the other side of the world to South Africa. So you flew to Vancouver, then you had to still get back to Idaho. You've been traveling in the last week a lot, but just tell us not about the travels, but about China and why you went there.
Yeah, I haven't been there since 2009. I think it was the first Beijing and Daba, mining and Daba. And my boss, Robbie Gonzalez, and I went. But we were spoiled then. People picked us up at the Beijing airport. We got in the train, went straight to Beijing, stayed in a hotel. We literally could walk to where the Indaba was being held. So you've got somebody holding your hand and you're not moving very much. And you just look around you. Now, Beijing, it was a little bit of everything. It was still under construction in 2008, 2009. There's a lot of new buildings going up around us. Hong Kong, I hadn't been in since 2003. And I was knocked off my feet. And I didn't make it all the way to Shenzhen. I haven't been to Shanghai. I imagine in 15 years, I'd barely recognize those places. But Hong Kong, China really started integrating during the student riots during COVID. It's now becoming as much a China as the other cities. But it's the civil engineering that knocked me out. I swear I saw five Golden Gate-sized bridges just running around Hong Kong. And some are suspension bridges, but some have a giant concrete pier in the middle and it goes. Others have the traditional big ramp like Golden Gate. The tunnels we went through, incredible size tunnels in Hong Kong, and apartment buildings that look like the World Trade Center. They're that high. And I didn't see any pollution. And we were zigzagging back and forth. No homeless people, no pollution. Almost everything is electric. And the cars that aren't electric are LNG. And we've been using LNG in our silver mines here for 50, 60 years because it's not noxious fumes. It doesn't kill you. And you can hardly, even the dirty old engines we used underground back in the 60s and 70s, you couldn't smell, you could hardly taste. Well, now these are much cleaner. So even the old taxis, the old vehicles you see on the road, they make no sound and they emit no noxious gas. So what a cleanup they've done. And then facial recognition is getting all over the place. You know, the whole airport's facial recognition. You put your passport in once, I don't even remember where. And after that, wherever you walk, your face comes up. And when you can organize 1.4 billion people, what is it to organize a few million tourists and businessmen that come in every day, right? And they've got you for life. So when I've got friends that say, yeah, I don't like being in somebody's files or records, I said, buddy, you were probably in them since the day you were born. You know, so who are you fooling? Everybody's got you. Look, the company we went to see, I can't say too much right now, but it's a listed company and it's a neat turnaround story. It's been listed quite a while and it wasn't performing very well. And since it's had new management and mainly the top manager, he's done an amazing job with it. It's almost up 100% in less than a year. And it's up on fundamentals. It's not up, you know, the companies involved in some metals that actually have done very poorly, Alec. And so that's what's neat. You know, when a company doesn't just run on the metal price, and I think we're going to talk about a couple companies like that in a bit here. You know, you like to know management's getting paid for something, that the metal price can be down, and yet they've innovated and they're cutting costs, they're rationalizing assets, and running a company, especially a diversified company, even if it's mining, it can be diversified in different commodities. It's like running a country. We always say, why do people kill themselves, these revolutionary movements trying to take over and run a country? Well, just look at what they got. You know, can you imagine the prize of taking over South Africa? It was Africa's engine room. You know, you've got unlimited money. You've got taxes that come in. It's not like a fund manager. You get so much and then you don't give me anything for a couple of years and see what you do with it. When you run a company or a country, you can blow all that money away and you get the same amount plus inflation the next year. And if that's not enough money on taxes, well, boy, you can issue bonds, right? If that's not enough, then you literally print bills, lower interest rates, sell assets or sell licenses, huh? Sell concessions, trade assets. Oh, my gosh. You know, I think we all, when in the next world, we all want to try and run a company and a country and see, you probably have less reporting in a country than you do. But yeah, let me not get sidetracked. I was very impressed with it. Security is strict and you've got to follow rules. And it kind of reminded me of my experience first coming to South Africa and starting on Harmony Gold Mine. It's mind-boggling. Even today, how did they manage 33,000 employees? 29,000 went underground every day, Alec. And those were tiny areas where they got the gold out of. But you're managing how many different tribes and dialects and nationalities, white and black? And yet they didn't just do it profitably and pretty darn safely. Yeah, there was fatalities, but they were improving all the time. They won more five-star shields than any mine in America I knew about. They did it through organizational genius. And that's what's happened in China. Organizational genius. You got 1.4 billion people pretty much going in one direction. And they want to be number one in everything they do. And they are, if they're not number one now, they're getting close to the few things they're not number one in. They've got drive and they got focus. And what they're doing, any country can do. That's the big lesson. Any country can do. You know, South Africa could go back to having mines, 62 listed gold mines, 30,000 men underground, and they could be productive and safe if they wanted to. But this government seems to want other things. Well, I'm rambling on.
Yeah, what a story though. And to get your experience to actually be there in person makes such a difference to it.
I felt like the wood tinsman who's been out in the rain for years. Remember how rusty he was when Dorothy found him in the field? That's exactly how I felt there, Allie. I'm Rip Van Winkle. I'm a rusty tinsman and the world has just run by me so fast. But I had some good arguments, discussions with their mining people. I think I can hold my own on an investment side, valuing. But that's a sliver I could hold my own, maybe. And I might be fooling myself.
Mm. Are you holding your own on gold? It's now. I'll tell you a little story. I started in financial journalism in January 1980. And if you recall, January 1980 was the great gold run. So yeah, I walk into my very first job and all I can see is every day the gold price is going higher and higher. Eventually it got to 850 at a fix, 875 at a point. It's just now in inflation adjusted terms exceeded that. So I've had a long career and gold has never been that high before and it's now gone through it. So it's got to be telling us something, Peter.
It is. And I usually get some kind of succor or confidence. I get some kind of comfort when I can put things on a graph, you know, put numbers on a graph. And at least it shows you where you are. You know, when you're lost in New York City and you find that big obelisk, or most cities, there's an obelisk, and you hug it and it's got a little map and it says, this is where you are. And now you've got a starting point. And so put this gold price on a graph. As you said, it's now touched the highest it ever got, which was probably virtually an intraday high. I doubt it was more than an interweek high. We've passed the yearly average way, way more than I think a year ago, or maybe it was earlier this year that we passed that real term average. So we are ballistic. We've left the gravity and the atmosphere of Earth on this gold price, Alec. And we can't compare the environment it's in with 1973. It's too different. You know, the world has been off the gold standard since 1973, and it's still off the gold standard. And we can say, okay, but who's buying it? That's what's really changed. Who's buying it? Because now, I don't think there were quite 200 countries in the world then, but probably a dozen or two really carried any weight. Well, more than a couple dozen carry weight now. And the big ones, it's not the U.S. is way, way up there and everybody else is multiples down. China is neck and neck with the U.S. in many more measurabilities than it's not. 1.4 billion people, it's way ahead of us. And if all those people are buying an ounce, like we always talked about, now they are kind of doing it. And there's a big, rich, powerful government that's bolstering its reserves. You know, didn't have anything like that in 1980. So all I see is relative to the S&P 500, gold isn't even at its long-term mean. You know, it could go up multiples from here if it replicated what it did in the 1970s, multiples, five times where it is today. So, yeah, it's beaten the S&P now. I've got a graph here somewhere, you know, if maybe over the last few years, but over the last 10 years, no. In fact, I'm going to call this up right now. Yeah, relative to the S&P, gold's where it was 7-8 years ago. You can say it's done nothing. It's exactly at the mean where it's been for the last 8 years. So if it gets to its long-term average, and I'm just starting in 1955 when I was born, because that's when the world really started, right? When I was born. Before then, it's not as relevant. So let's go back to when Petersky here was born. Gold was about 1-to-1 with the S&P. So today it's about 0.55. So it can double today relative to the S&P, and it's just back to where its long-term average is. That would be its 70-year average. So it can go up much more.
So don't run away from gold. If you're invested, stay with it. If you aren't invested,
cry. and Bitcoin, I think relative to Bitcoin, they've been neck and neck here for like the last 6 years. You know, sometimes gold fell to a third of what Bitcoin was. Sometimes Bitcoin fell to a third of what gold was. But I think as of today, they're kind of neck and neck. Bitcoin's for young generation, gold's for the new generation. Well, for the old generation.
It sounds like in your portfolio, given the turbulence in the world, given the fact that things are probably going to get more turbulent rather than less, you should have some gold and some Bitcoin in there.
I'll never say you should have some Bitcoin because I don't know it, understand, or trust it. But yeah, I think you need some form of gold. In the old days, living in South Africa, you just had to live in South Africa and you benefited by the gold price because it was more than 50% of our foreign currency. It was more than 50% of our mining industry and it paid huge taxes and it built that country. So just by living in South Africa up until about 20, 25 years ago, everybody benefited by gold. But now very few benefit with gold in South Africa. You know, and it shouldn't be like that, but it is. And yeah, let's give credit where credit's due. You know, our government did a good job at taking away the country's dependence on gold, much to our detriment. So now you do need gold in your portfolio, whether you work for a gold company or you live in a town that has a profitable gold mine in it, or you buy some coins or you buy some equity, or you do like me. Yeah, I think the equities were overvalued and too risky, and so I just bought a mine, which that's a hell of a risk, yeah, putting all that money in a mine. But yeah, we'll make multiples if the gold price even falls 30%. But it takes a few years, and it takes a lot of money and hard work. But I do think you need some kind of exposure to gold, or if you believe in Bitcoin, then take that. But I don't believe in it.
And I guess that leads us very, very well into the whole cadastre. Is that the way you pronounce it?
Cadastre, yes. Oh, that word. Yeah. Who knew what a cadastre was 25 years ago? I'll tell you who knew. South Africa knew, Alec. South Africa knew exactly what it was. The Council for Geoscience They knew exactly what it was. And they wanted to be, and they acted like they were, the top council for geoscience on the planet. They were world class. And they acted like it. They believed it. They worked like it. And they had the pedigree and the people and the projects to prove it. And how were they going to cement that image in the world's mind in the new millennium? They had the perfect way. They had developed the most modern cadastre yet, and it was benchmarked against world best. And they were ready to launch in the new millennium. They were already at a high level, and now they're going to launch the best cadastre anybody's got based on their, 75, 80 years of experience and knowledge. They were going to list. And then what happened? They got called in 2002, and they said, you people aren't quite leading edge like you think. You might be in mining, but it's politics that run this country. It's not mining. And there's going to be some seismic shifts in politics. And we know you guys were doing the best you could, but you're going to have some new management here, and you're going to have some new directives. And these projects you're working on, like the Skidastra, that's not going to take precedence for a while. We don't really need that. We have more pressing issues like transformation. And so it's like that thing was intentionally sabotaged. It was intentionally removed. So here we are again talking about Evel Knievel, Alec, you and me, right? Evel's done all the preparation. He's got the ramp. He's got NASA scientists that build him a sky cycle that's going to jump the Grand Canyon with ease. And just as it's launching, the parachute was deployed. In Evel's case, it was accidentally. In this case, it was knowingly, premeditated, willingly. We deployed the parachute, and we relegated ourselves from number one in the world on a cadastre system that kept track of all the mineral properties in the country, who owned them, the size, what's on it, how can you get it, what are the terms and conditions of whoever owns that. We went from front of 200 countries to as far back as our government could push us.
So just unpack a cadastre. What is a cadastre?
It's a system. Nowadays, it's an electronic system. Before, it was a file system of keeping track of all the mineral properties in this country. Now, minerals used to be owned by the landowners. The government owned quite a few hectares, quite a few millions of hectares, but the majority of the country was owned by private individuals. And yet, to mine it, you still had to have permission from the government. You still had to fulfill certain requirements. And just one of the many requirements was you had to pay tax. You had to pay royalties and some. So this government and country benefited much more from the money made on these mines than shareholders ever got in dividends. You know, let's have that fallacy buried once and for all. Okay, now once you nationalize everything, now you really need an effective working cadastre, especially all these privately held mineral properties. They were held for a reason by the various mining companies. They're not holding on and paying taxes for nothing. You know, they believe there's a future there. They put work into it. So you didn't have this plethora of new licenses being issued left and right. You didn't have half the population that didn't have a clue what they're doing, but they all want mineral rights. Well, now you do. You've nationalized them in 2004. Now the government owns all the minerals in the country. And so to get the minerals back if you're an existing company, or to apply for minerals if you're a new company, you've got to go to the DMR. And can you imagine the massive rush, you know, like a stadium with the Beatles appearing or the Rolling Stones? Everybody's rushing to government. We want to take out a mineral property. So probably no staff or administration could have handled it. They weren't prepared for it. And they didn't have an electronic cadastre system that would have made filing much easier to keep track of, to process. No, it's all done by hand. And I know people keep saying this seems more intentional than accidental. Yeah, after 25 years, it does seem intentional because it's opaque, it's confusing. And worst of all that, even worse than being corrupt, it is so inefficient that we could be taking advantage of this 25-year bull run in commodities, and we wouldn't be in the poor state we're in. We wouldn't have driven away investment if we could grant licenses in a reasonable time without all the associated delays, corruption, mistakes. I haven't really explained what the cadastre is, huh? Electronic file system of all the mineral properties and rights.
So if I understand correctly, the mineral rights in South Africa were privately owned. the majority of them anyway. And that meant the private sector got going. You had to pay tax and you had to get permission from government if you were going to mine. So the government got money, but the private sector got onto it. So if you had minerals that were worth extracting, then you would invest and do so. And maybe some you'd have a go because in the future you would believe that a particular mineral would rise in price. It's the private sector. It's the market mechanism. That all became owned by government. And then government decided who got those mineral rights. Is that correct?
Yeah, they do. Now officially, whoever puts his application in first should get it. But more often than not, that's not the case. And even if that person gets it, he has to jump through so many hoops. He has to wait so many years. He has to answer so many questions or reapply. And a very important factor that gets left out, Alec, is when these were private mineral rights, say Anglo-American had Western Deep Levels, they've hit the vein, the ore body, they see which direction it goes, and they say, hey, we want to have a 150-year mine. We put all this work into shafts, the mill, you know, let's amortize it out over a bigger area and mine even more gold. Okay, Farmer Joe next door's got the property. So Anglo's goes, Western Deep would knock on his door, say, we'd like to talk a deal with your farm. Now, more often than not, the farmer would talk some kind of deal. And if it was outrageous, they'd say, okay, we'll talk to you in 50 years. And if it wasn't outrageous, they'd say, gee, let's buy it. And the farmer, you know, does he really want to farm next to a giant mine that's got 20,000 people running by his house every day, you know, and his animals and his crops, they may be at risk. So it was a willing buyer, willing sale. Now, what happens today, Alec? I might find some good minerals or I might come across a file of a closed mine. And I say, this mine never should have closed. I know there's minerals in it. I talked to the geologist, talked to the mine manager. But now I've got to go to the government and apply for the rights. Okay, I can do that. But there's a landowner on there. And maybe this landowner doesn't want to sell. Now, theoretically, government can expropriate it, but they never do. So now the landowners can be very difficult because they don't get those minerals. They used to own those minerals. They were taken away. So I'll tell you what, Alec, most landowners I go to see, if they've been there, the longer they've been there, the more pissed off. And they blame me. They say, no, you're not going to come here, or you're going to pay me another royalty, another set of taxes. Now I'm paying double taxes because I got to pay the government royalty and taxes. But so now, was it Jesus? You know, they're trying to trick him. You know, who do I serve, Caesar or you? Well, boy, we are in that predicament, Alec. If you're in mining, you got the landowner you got to deal with, and he can be very difficult because he's mad. He got his mineral rights taken away from him, and he got nothing for him. And now I'm there and he says, oh, so you're getting my mineral rights. Yeah, well, I'm going to make your life as fun as mine, Pete. And it's an unnecessary added complexity that we never had before. Either the guy wanted to do a deal or he didn't. And that was it. But now you have to deal with them. Sometimes they won't let you on their property. It's like serving notice. The sheriff comes to your house to repossess it. Well, you don't answer the door. You know, you can make it miserable for him. So that was one of the unintended consequences when government did this. They've made it much more difficult on the whole, by far, to establish a mine, to even prospect.
Well, that's unintended consequences, a big, big story that we know here in South Africa. We seem to specialize in that by doing things that with hindsight are dumb. And then, of course, we don't change them. But who knows, maybe into the future. But the whole cadastre system now, where is it? Is there any progress being made on that?
Look, I'm a Catholic, so we were indoctrinated with terms like limbo, purgatory, hell, heaven. Well, it's not in that last one. Is it in hell? I think it is, Alec, you know, because hell is as bad as it gets. And that's how it's been for the last 25 years or the last 20. It's as bad as it gets today. So if I could tell you we're 50% there, well, then we'd be in purgatory, right? And limbo is you're not burning, but you're not going anywhere. You're kind of stuck in Groundhog Day. So, that's where we are. Now, this is another kicker. When I go to look at some of our clients' properties north of here, starting with Zambia, they got a cadastre that's made by a company in Cape Town. They've had it for 20 years. And I'm one step from brain dead working on a computer. And I can see there now as I'm talking to you, I can go in that cadastre system and I can find most of the properties I need. It says when it was granted, terms and conditions, when it expires, who's got it. I can even find out who my neighbors are. So if I want to talk to somebody next to me and I want to incorporate it, or maybe I want to sell, this is Zambia. And Zambia is backwards from us in so many respects. They've had this cadastre system for over 20 years. And it's an off-the-shelf unit built here in Cape Town. So government is going out of their way not to implement something that would have worked 20 years ago, 10, 5. They're being cute. Is it because they want to have macro, micro control over every aspect? Or are they used to getting kickbacks and they don't want to just buy something off the shelf? You know, they don't get a kickback for buying Microsoft Windows. Or maybe they do. Maybe they only buy it from a dealer that pays kickbacks. I just don't know. But it's intentional. They could have had this and they willfully have not implemented it. They've played games for 20 years and it's blatant.
Well, at one point in time, the truth will come out and the people of South Africa will punish these who have visited misery on the economy unnecessarily. Let's move on to the one-time champion of South Africa, Anglo-American. We've spoken about that in Mining Web Weekly a few times. And there's tech deal. Now the Canadians are feeling a little bit uncomfortable about the deal. They don't necessarily want Duncan Wanblad to be running one of their prize assets. What's going on there, Peter?
Look, if I knew this was an adult program, I could use some real cute language. But when I first read the Canadians' worries, doubts, and complaints, you know, I shouldn't say this, you know, my heart pumps piss. And I printed out an A4 copy of it. And I recognized it immediately because when I was an analyst back in the 90s, when most people weren't born, and I got a little bit, no, it's just as bad as when I was a fund manager. So Anglos or any company wants to merge or they want to buy or they want to unlist, delist a company, a share, and they come to see us at the institutions, right? And we've all got to pretend we know what we're doing. We got to pretend we're the masters of the universe. So we'd go to the tuck shop. You know, you got that machine and you put in some money and you can get a candy bar or poison chips or a bad soft drink. Well, one of the columns was reasons we don't want to do this deal. Yeah. And so you'd pull that lever and a piece of paper would come out. And the Anglos and all the mining people have probably heard it so many times. So here's all us punk analysts and fund managers. We think you're grossly undervaluing this deal. We don't think it's good for the stock market. We don't think it's good for the country. We don't think. And look, they would cajole us because they wanted the deal to go through. And they would methodically try and answer, what are your real concerns? And most of our concerns they could destroy pretty easy because they were bullshit concerns. Well, those ones I saw, the Canadians, please. They've had 150 years to create some mining titans, and they haven't done it yet. And now they don't want my Anglos taking tech because tech was going to be the next Billiton. Please, you know. And we think it was window dressing, putting the head office in Vancouver, but you're keeping the listing in London. Oh. So why don't you guys start up the Vancouver Stock Exchange? Maybe we'll list on that. But your Toronto Stock Exchange is so freaking dead that even Newmont's delisting from it. You know, so the Canadians don't have much to cry about. That's probably their biggest problem. You know, it's a giant rich country. There's maybe 35, maybe 40 million. I don't know. It's so sparse. You know, they're so spread out. It's hard to do a census there. So, yeah, I thought most of the reasons there were hot air. And how many shares do each of those complainers hold? But we all know governments, just like analysts and fund managers, Alec, they always feel when someone asks them a question, they have to give a superior answer to justify their job. You know, what's government even got to do with friggin' mining? Like we said, it's the private sector that risks their money, that risks getting dropped out of a helicopter on a frozen peak and frostbitten hands trying to find ore on top of a glacier in Canada. You know, it's how much work did government do? They issued a license and they made sure they got their fees paid. So, yeah, honest, I didn't see anything there that I thought was a genuine reason. This is a marriage. This is shareholders and shareholders. I remember telling Gwede Montash at one of, I think it was one of Bernard's and Daba's in 2022, 2023, the first one that after COVID. And I said, Gwede, you know what we did during COVID? When this is the height of the lockdown. It's on my birthday, Gwede. We bought a silver mine in Idaho. We never left our seat. Me and two associates, we bought it. Three South Africans, we bought a silver mine in USA during COVID, May 16th, 2020. And he says, wow. You know, he seemed impressed. So I said, wow, if you're kind of impressed, should I tell you something really impressive, buddy? The government didn't even know about it. Boy, then he was impressed, Alec. Then his eyes popped. You know, 100-watt bulbs turned into 300-watt bulbs. No, he couldn't believe that. How could we buy a mine and government didn't know about it? And then I explained, it was real easy. It was none of their goddamn business. It was a business deal. We didn't break any rules. We followed all the rules. Huh? South Africans bought a mine. Neil Frohman bought a mine in the States. Did he need government permission? Well, let's end there. So,
you mentioned Newmont, which is run by a South African, delisting from the Toronto Stock Exchange. Is there a backstory to that?
I'm at the bottom of the food chain to know what's really going on in mining. Huh? I just fill in a few gaps, Alec. So the official announcement was, and I believe it, I don't think it's a conspiracy. They said the cost was too high. It tied up manpower. It tied up money. You know, a lot of regulations there. And we know all you got to do is break one regulation accidentally, and it could lead to all kinds of giant consequences. So they said the volumes traded didn't warrant it being there anymore. And we've seen that on the JSE. We've seen it in New York. And it's, look, it's a worrying trend. I've said since I can remember, certainly since 1990 on. Okay, I sound like a dictator. You know, I used to say governments should force companies to list because it made their life so easy. You know, they didn't have to do any investigation. They saw exactly what the company was. You know, reporting standards made a company disclose almost everything. Now government, as we know, in our coal sector, our chrome mines, they don't know what's going on. Who does? Nobody knows what's going on, huh? It's all our minerals are being produced. Well, most of them are still being produced by listed companies, but it's becoming smaller and smaller. And the U.S. is really suffering from this. I think the New York Stock Exchange has less companies in probably 100 some years because it's onerous keeping these listings up, and it can open you to all kinds of liabilities and lawsuits. And so, yeah, it's a business decision. It's a business decision. They can't justify it. And Newmont is big. And I won't say the talk of the town, but everybody in America on the mining side that I've dealt with here continues to tell me how bloated Billiton and Newmont are. And these are contractors and people. I won't say they're as senior level as Natasha and Palmer, you know, the two people running it. But they say to get anything done, the bureaucracy is mind-boggling. And they've admitted themselves. They're looking at retrenching. I can't remember how many hundreds it was. It's just duplication. And they're selling off assets. They're selling off gold. They got to rationalize. Barrick and Newmont, I'd hate to justify that company to an investor. They must have some good investment, presenters. Because it doesn't outperform the gold price. It doesn't outperform the S&P. It's fallen multiples over the years to the gold price. It's fallen multiples over the years to the S&P. So why would you buy it, Alec? Yeah, they've got to cut costs. As we already said, the Chinese company I was visiting, cutting costs is a great way to improve profitability for shareholders. It's a great way to streamline it, to become efficient, to become modern, become desired, get a higher rating on the index instead of a low rating. So, long answer, it's an easy question. I take it at face value. They said it's not justifiable. Trade's too small.
progress in that regard anyway. Maybe the South African CEO is going to make a difference on the cost-cutting side, bringing someone from outside. Just to close off with a couple of local stories I'd love to get your thoughts on. Steenkampskraal and the investment by the IDC. Can you tell us a little about that project?
Only a little. I've heard about it. I've talked to the IDC about it. I've talked to Steenkampskraal about it for a decade, Alec, for more than a decade. But it's always been airy-fairy. And the IDC, sometimes they want more than they can grasp. And Steenkampskraal is very small. It's very rich. Everybody's known about it. It had some complex, difficult owners. They wanted to sell it or bring a JV under very certain circumstances. We had the mandate trying to market it. I thought we had some good offers. But so the IDC, I don't know how much they're involved. I hear all the time they would like to be involved. Some people at the IDC have told me over the 10 years, we really want to be involved. The rumor of them being involved has actually scared away some investors because they say, we don't want to go through all the work of JVing or buying this. And we find out, oh, government's declared it a strategic asset. And now they're interfering in our management of it. They're interfering in our exploitation of it. And it could be a little bit of a poison pill. If the IDC plays a big role in this, they may, it'll be like a tar baby. You know, they may say, we're just going to help nurture it for a little bit, but they may find out it sticks to them and they can't then onsell it onto someone else. I've been involved in some other deals the IDC was in, and some of the companies I've dealt with said, we would love to get involved there, Pete, but one of the conditions is the IDC has to agree to sell their shareholding, just because we don't want to tie up too much management time. And we know they're very thorough. They know what they're doing, but they have a huge board, Alex, and the protocol of getting things done there is enormous and time-consuming. This is a little asset, Steenkampskraal. It's great if the IDC gets involved to start it up, but is it justified? I saw a number bandied about. I can't believe it's true. $20 to $30 million they're going to put in for phase one, and they're talking six phases. My gosh, if you gave me 10% of that, I'd show you what I could do in South Africa. You know, that's huge money for a tiny mine. And they're talking about beneficiating at all these different levels, which is great, but if it's only for a little bit of ore, how much money, time are we going to spend on that beneficiation? Are we adding value? Are we creating jobs? Or is it just for a headline in the paper? There's more questions with the story than answers.
And the Industrial Development Corporation was created to develop industry. And I presume a few mines as well. I'm not sure, but certainly it was Sasol and it was Iscor. And those kind of
steel,
organizations.
I think. Yeah, they were involved in a lot of great projects, but sometimes them staying was not warranted. Sometimes it was. And, they can do a lot of good. They've got tremendous experience there. They've got a huge balance sheet, but it has grown more monolithic and administratively huge. And you know, this is a little project. And is this going to save South Africa? Jeez, I don't know how much time and money they're going to put in it, but I hope it's balanced with rate of return.
Orion Glencore, that deal?
That is a headline we all thought we were going to read 5-6 years ago. It's a headline we've wanted to read. Orion's had the Prieska project for at least 7 years. And geez, these last 7 years, copper's done great. That thing should have been running a long time ago. But it shows how hard it was to get funding. You know, Errol Smart put in tremendous work. I don't know anybody that sleeps less than him on a regular basis. And trying to raise funding to develop a mine that we knew so much about. You know, I was worried. He had 15 drill rigs there, Alec. The holes and the quarries got, they had the biggest core shed I've ever seen. And I think they had double the cores outside of it. I was really worried that he probably took out 50% of the resources just through core drilling. And yet, 7 years, now they're getting pretty close to looking like being a full-funded operation. And that's it. You can't push the button until you know you got that funding. And you got to have some contingency funding just in case. But the environment's ready for that mine. Jeez, it's been ready for 5 or 6 years. So that was fantastic news. And Glencore's, they're a real funder. You know, it's not this complicated mezzanine with a lot of no-name, tiny little funders with borrowed balance sheets. Glencore, you know, world's arguably one of the world's top five traders, huge balance sheet. And yeah, they need the offtake. All these traders, this is the new funding model of the world in the new millennium. It's offtakers and mainly traders are now having to fund mines if they want to secure the product. It's too competitive out there. So that's where mines are now getting their money, not off the stock exchange, not from the banks and institutions like they used to. They're getting it from new sources, streaming and offtakers and traders.
So if you were investing on a monthly basis, if you took a view, because this is what we're going to be doing at BizNews from the end of this month, we'll have a number of stocks and we'll be putting in a certain amount every month, continuously, rand cost averaging. Remember that beautiful policy of investing. Would Orion be one that you'd look at, or is there something better? Because we're talking here almost a forever stock. You're going to be putting in your 1,000 rand a month for many years, or at least that's the intention until, or should something go wrong, then of course you change.
Ryan is the kind of stock I generally was looking for in my portfolios when I was full-time managing money. I looked at stocks that were trading at percentages of what I thought their NAV was. And Orion definitely fits that. You know, there's enough analyst reports out there, enough definitive feasibility studies to show this thing is probably trading around 25 cents on the buck. Maybe it goes as high as 30, 35 cents on the buck. And when it was down there at 13 cents, it was probably trading at 15 cents on the buck. Just if you look at the assets in that portfolio, that is, it looks like a tiny junior. You know, its market cap is, what, 65? Well, now it's gone up. It's probably got $80 million market cap. But gee, just one of those assets it's got can justify that market cap easy, Alec. You know, whether it's Prisca or the O'Keefe division and even its exploration portfolio and Jakobsmin, the nickel project, you know, that each of those on their own will justify that share price. So yeah, that's the kind of share that I usually am looking for to put in a portfolio. Now, they don't have the momentum of something that's producing regular earnings, but if I'm getting it at 20, 25 cents on the buck, and I think somebody's going to make this thing work, it's too juicy to just sit there, put it, you know, I've seen Tim Alsop buy shares like that. Jan Bickard bought shares like that. And yeah, if I was running a portfolio now, that would definitely be in there.
Well, there we have one for the Ricardo portfolio, end of the month. We are going to be putting Orion into it. Peter Major, as always, it's been such a joy having a chat. I know you. I hope you've recovered from your travels and that you'll be, when are you back home? When do you get back to South Africa?
Yeah, everything goes right. I'm going to be landing in good old South Africa on the 1st of October, Alec.
Fantastic. So that means...
Then this hot air I'm expending now, if we're doing this live, it'll put you to sleep. So it's good we're doing it through the computer. It filters all the hot air I'm putting out.
Well, look forward to seeing you. And of course, at the Joburg Indaba, that's very exciting.
That's a great catch-up. Yeah, that is a super Indaba. Anybody that wants to know what's going on in South African mining has got to be at that Indaba. It's very, very good, intensive 2.5 days.
And that's on the 8th and the 9th of October. Peter and I will both be there catching up on what's happening here. And we'll be back, though, with the Mining Web Weekly next week. Peter Majors with Modern Corporate Solutions. I'm Alec Hogg from BizNews.com.